On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we congratulate Pete Alonso for breaking the all-time Mets home run record. We chat about his journey, his path to this very cool moment. We chat about franchise home run records. We chat about Jose Ramirez and him stealing bases and knocking home runs. We take a path into Jordan's prospect hut to talk about the updated midseason prospect lists. We get some breaking news on the show involving the Minnesota Twins, and then we yell at Shohei Ohtani's agent for just what are we doing here. Hello, and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world who thinks that Pete Alonso should just be called Mr. Met. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman, and that would make Pete Alonso's wife Mrs. Met. Now, you know, like all these other franchises, their best player, you know, Tony Gwynn, Mr. Padre, Ryan Zimmerman, Mr. National. But Pete Alonso, is he not Mr. Met? You see what I'm saying here?
That's a good point. I don't know how many more home runs he would need to hit to, you know, really like for people to call him that, because this is a bit of a conundrum. He does have his own nickname already, right? The polar bear was part of Gary Cohen's great call for his historic home run on Tuesday night, which is going to be our first topic. But yeah, no, it's a good point. This is a bit of a dilemma here.
I like Gary Cohen. Love the Mets broadcast. Didn't love the call. Sorry. Not trying to yuck yums.
Oh, wow. Great moment for Pete. Way to start.
We're
going to
talk
pod.
About it.
Unbelievable. Hey,
it's important
Jake's
to share
back,
opinions.
And Jake's back, and he's not holding back, folks. He's bringing you. He's been holding up these takes for 5 days as he was on vacation. The great Lance Brozdowski filled in on Monday. But it is good to have you back. And yes, Jake, let us get to our opener. It's the polar bear.
Pete Alonso woke up yesterday, Tuesday, August 12th, tied for the career lead in home runs by a New York Met. And last night against Spencer Strider, he clubbed number 253 to pass Daryl Strawberry for the most home runs in franchise history. Huzzah to you, Pete.
Yeah, I would say 254 home runs now, as he actually had two home runs on Tuesday night, is a lot of home runs to have in just seven major league seasons, really six and a half when you consider, you know, he lost 100 games during 2020. This has been, not just in Mets history, but in baseball history, one of the most prolific starts to a career from a home run perspective that we have seen. And for Pete Alonso to now have this franchise record, a record that is very interesting to think about in the larger context of baseball history. And we'll kind of talk about how it compares to other franchise home run records. But I know you've been thinking a lot about Pete, the character, Pete, the player, where he fits on this year's Mets team and his career. So before we zoom farther out, let's talk about Mr. Alonso himself, Mr. Met, as you maybe will want
Mr.
to call
Met.
Him one day.
Mr. Met, I'm sure that will be what people call him now. So Pete is such a fascinating amateur track. So he is famous-ish relatively young because he's at a big high school. Plant High School in Tampa has high profile and scouts are in there to see players all the time. But because he's a right-handed hitting first baseman, he ends up matriculating to the University of Florida. And while at Florida, it's a very up and down career. He has a lot of weird injuries. He hits a ball off of his face in the batting cage and breaks his nose. He breaks his hand getting hit by a pitch. He has one summer in the Northwoods League playing for the Madison Mallards, where he hits 18 home runs over a summer, which is an outrageous amount for a summer league. And he I believe is the all-time, he's like one of the greatest players in Madison Mallards history. And then the next summer he goes to the Cape and is just not very good. He hits zero home runs on the Cape, which is wild to think about. And then down the stretch, his junior year right before the draft, he kind of shortens up his swing a little bit and he goes on a heater leading up to the draft, and he's taken in the second round with the 64th overall pick. He is the 18th college hitter selected. He is the third Met selected after Justin Dunn and Anthony Kay. And most notably, he is the fifth Florida Gator taken. in that draft. Okay. And so for a player, like, I don't want to frame Pete as like a diamond in the rough or an underrated find, or this is not Mike Piazza being taken in a round that no longer exists. Like, Pete was well known. He was taken high. He got a bonus just shy of $1 million. But he was a relative afterthought the morning after the draft. To the point, like, if you go and watch the draft broadcast, you have the first thing that gets said after John Franco, Mets icon, announces Pete's pick is Greg Amsinger going, the fifth player taken out of the University of Florida today, right? Like, that was the narrative. And so for Pete to go from that to this, I think is a testament to who he is as a hitter and the adjustments he was able to make at the big league level to shorten up his swing and get to the most of his juice.
Yeah, and you know, the era that he played in college baseball was not nearly as hitter friendly as it is now. That said, when you go back and look, and I know injuries contributed to some of this, but 23 home runs in 157 college games, even, and that's when people did think, all right, this is a big guy with real power, right? For that to become the all-time Mets home run leader, not that much long. I mean, we're not even 10 years removed from that, right? We are basically, not even 10 years removed from him being drafted. It speaks to the complete hitter that I think everybody underestimated, clearly. But, you know, there are a lot of prodigious sluggers in college that get drafted in the second to fourth round every year. And a very small percentage of them end up being like impact guys. And that is what Pete has become. And that's just when we're just talking about, you know, the player, the scouting, the stats, obviously what he has become for this franchise. And most notably in the narrative scope of this, what he almost was not, as how his free agency went and whether he was going to leave. There's so much with the Pete story just over the last year or two that makes it all the more compelling that we got to this point, which we might not have, right? I mean, a year ago, we said, okay, yeah, Pete's surely going to stay. And then we were like, Pete's surely going to leave. And then, well, he's not going to get this record. But, you know, this year, to have the season that he's having and to be able to get this record, and who knows how many more he's going to add to it, not just this year, but in the future, as we assume he will be a free agent again, that also makes this compelling.
He's got to keep Juan Soto at bay. Soto's already gunning for the Mets home run record. Because the Mets record, right, 253 is the third fewest of any franchise, right? The only franchises to have a lower record are the D-backs with Luis Gonzalez at 224 and the Padres with Manny Machado at 167. And it is interesting that the Mets are so low on this list considering how long they have existed for. They have been around for quite a long time. And I think it is a testament to their inability to keep their best players around, or that their most impact power hitters are acquired via free agency, right? If you look at the list, okay, it's Pete, it's Daryl Strawberry, who would have had probably twice the amount of homers if his career hadn't gotten derailed. It's David Wright, who would have flown past Strawberry if injuries hadn't derailed him. And then it's like Piazza, Dodger, Marlin, legend, you know, Athletic. He was on other teams. Beltran on other teams. Howard Johnson on other teams. And so Pete breaking this record because he stayed for at least for a year, I think is a very poetic way for this to happen. And even more fitting in a kind of sad roundabout way is the idea that it might not continue. And that is what has fascinated me so much about Pete's season, is that it is like, it's almost like legacy purgatory, because instead of deciding what the rest of his career is actually going to look like, that everyone just kicked the can down the road a year. They were like, we'll deal with this later. They procrastinated. I know there were a lot of other reasons why Pete ended up back on the Mets, but from a narrative perspective, it's like, okay, do we build a statue, or is he going to be on the Reds next year? Like, what is this now?
Yeah. It's a great point. I think, yeah, legacy purgatory is a perfect way to put it. But I would also say, yes, you are factually correct. He did break this record because he stayed. He also broke this record because he hit so many home runs.
So many home runs.
6 years of his career before even reaching free agency, right? 53 as a rookie, which is inflated because, yes, 2019 was an all-time juice ball outrageous circus. But then to come back after, you know, the pandemic and hit 37, 40, 46, 34, the dude posts. This is the other thing we've talked about, Pete, even since we've been talking about him as a free agent. This guy doesn't miss games. All those weird injuries that he was dealing with in college, a lot of which were flukes, was like it's exactly what it was, because this guy has never been on the injured list, I think, or at least maybe once. Again, you look at his games played. Of course, he plays 162 last year. That helps when you're able to be that consistent and rack up that amount of homers and that amount of games. So yeah, no, it's such an interesting confluence of factors about him as a player, about the team that he was on, the franchise history, the free agency. And to your point, where this goes from here remains interesting, because here's the thing. Even if they sign him to another, presumably if he comes back, it's not going to be on another 1 year deal. It's going to be at least a little bit longer, but it's probably not going to be a 7 or 8 or 9 year deal, right? And so he's could still add to this, but you mentioned Soto jokingly, but that's true, man. Like that dude's going to be, he's probably going to catch Pete at some point, assuming he's going to be there for a very, very, very long time. I guess Lindor is probably not that close, and he's obviously much older. So, but either way, Pete will at least have this record for a good amount of time.
The Pete Alonso transaction log is really hilarious. If you go to a player's page on MLB.com and scroll to the bottom, they have their transaction log. Pete's transaction log is like invited to big league camp, contract selected, 2 year gap, 10 day injured list, right hand sprain. 10 days later, activated, assigned to National League All-Stars, United States activated Pete Alonso. And then it's Pete Alonso changed number to 42. For Jackie Robinson. Like he was on the IL, I believe, twice, both times for the minimum amount of time, both hand related. He probably just got hit.
Okay.
What a player. Sure. What a just a really impressive amount of postability. You're right. He shows up and he plays. So let's congrats, Pete, Mr. Met, as they call him. Let's pivot to franchise home run leaders, because I think we're going to use Pete as kind of this entryway into what we see, think is a very interesting topic, because the list of all-time franchise home run leaders, like calling Pete Alonso the Mets home run king, is something that is going to make people who do Philly drive time radio scream their eyeballs out. Chill a little bit. It's okay. It's going to be fine. We think that this is an interesting type of player or way to think about players and what they mean to certain teams.
Well, it also, it as you sort of alluded to talking about the other Mets greats, it just says a lot about some of these franchises. I mean, some of these are small sample sizes and they do just have one player who happened to be there and hit a ton of homers. You know, we talked about, you mentioned Luis Gonzalez and Manny Machado, a couple of the other like lower totals, Evan Longoria with the Rays at 261. That's not surprising, but the Rays, you would think about those younger franchises, right? And that is the D-backs. That is the Rays. The Rockies had Todd Helton, so they have a little bit of a larger one. The Marlins, it's still Giancarlo Stanton and is probably going to be for like an extremely long time. I don't know who is second. I guess maybe
Augustin Ramirez, get cooking.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Talk about, are they going to be able to keep him? That is going to be one to monitor. But Stanton's probably going to have that for a long time at 267. Then Ryan Zimmerman, we mentioned it, 284, Mr. National there. But we also have to think about the ones who could become this. Who are some players that could have moments like Pete while we are doing this podcast? Now, maybe not this season, unless Salvador Perez goes absolutely ballistic in the last 6 weeks and hits like 20 home runs, he could catch up to George Brett, who is the Royals' all-time home run leader at 317, Salvi at 294. So if Salvi plays another season or two, like that looks to be the most likely one that we will see soon. The longer-term ones to keep in mind are Jose Ramirez, who I'm going to talk about more in a second because he hit two more home runs last night. Vlad Jr. is well behind Carlos Delgado, but he'll probably get there one day now that we know he will be a Blue Jay for life. The other ones to monitor, I mean, Julio, again, you have to look at players that you know are going to be in one place for a long time. I guess you could also mention Bobby Witt, right, in that case. I guess you could also mention Corbin Carroll, for that matter, if we're talking about the D-backs, potentially, depending on how long that contract goes. You can mention Julio. The problem with Julio is, you know, it's a much higher target with Ken Griffey at 417. But if he's there for, you know, 10 years, I mean, he's already over 100. That's not completely implausible. We mentioned Juan Soto maybe one day passing Pete. Francisco Lindor is at 131. Could he get to the number Pete is at now? Yes, probably, but it's a little bit less likely, I think, especially if Pete continues to add. And then Tatis is the other one where Machado's going to keep adding because he has this extension, but Tatis is also on this huge extension. So he's only like 20 behind Machado. So that's one that you could see someday, but that is well into the future. So Salvador Perez is really the next one that could happen very, very realistically next season. Other than that, some of these other ones we might be waiting.
One of my favorite things is that Barry Bonds does not lead any franchises in home runs. Besides, you know, the franchise of Major League Baseball. Willie Mays is the all-time leader for the Giants, and Willie Stargell is the all-time leader for the Pirates, and therefore Barry Bonds, despite leading the world in the homers, does not lead any specific franchise. I think that James Wood has a shot at the Ryan Zimmerman one in time. I think that is one worth mentioning.
Scott Boris might have something to say about that. I would love for you to be right for, you know, my Nats fan brother and the people who want to watch James Wood in DC for the next 15 years. So yeah, maybe. I mean, it's certainly a long-term one. He certainly has the talent to do so, but that requires a lot of years in DC that is going to probably be at a discount that Scott Boris is not super fond of.
And then the other one is, you know, Frank Thomas is at 448. And what's Colson Montgomery at this point, right?
Like, that's true. Dude, if he can keep this pace, he might not even have to, you know, sign an extension. I mean, he might be able to get this done by the end of his ARB years, I would say. So, yeah, that's true. That's definitely one we're going to have to monitor.
Montgomery's on a 62 homer pace right now over a full season. He does that for 10 years. I mean, that's like... It's so many home runs.
We're chilling. We're chilling. Yeah. So that's true. Honestly, we should just put it in the calendar. We got to get ready for the Colson Montgomery franchise.
Statue.
Wow. Man, I shouldn't. You're right. I should have thought about him. All right. One more in this vein that we need to take a moment on before we take a break is Jose Ramirez. Now, this is a player who almost to a comical degree is just like the guy you'd be like, man, we're not talking about him enough. Oh, man, you know, underrated, which has some truth to it. And also you should roll your eyes at this point because he is going to be a Hall of Famer and he has been doing this for almost 10 years now. So none of this should be a huge shock. That said, as I have now moved to Northeast Ohio and get to watch Jose Ramirez on a regular basis, that same old cliche, you appreciate it more watching it every day. That is accurate. And being around him, watching him just break all these different records, most recently the most multi-home run games in franchise history, his 27th on Tuesday night, basically just single-handedly winning the game for Cleveland as they continue to push into surprisingly close in the postseason race. One game right there behind the Yankees. So, but we'll keep the larger, you know, Guardians picture out of this for now. But man, I mean, he is, I think what's so amazing about him, and you know, we've seen a couple other players be able to do this. You know, the players who do not look like sluggers that have become sluggers. And I asked Jose about this in his post game last night, just like, you know, when did you realize like, okay, yeah, I could just be a home run hitter. You know, no one is expecting you to be a home run hitter. And, you know, he talked about that, right, that there was a time when he realized, yes, I can hit home runs, but it took a while to realize what it would take to do that on a regular basis and to understand to maximize his strengths as a switch hitter, but as a guy who doesn't have huge raw power. This is what Mookie Betts is amazing at. This is what Alex Bregman is amazing at. This is what Jose Altuve is amazing at. You saw it again last night. Both home runs, wall scrapers. Guess what? Doesn't matter. Counts the same. And the dude now has 280 career home runs. Jim Thome is the all-time leader for the franchise with 337. Ramirez under contract for 3 more years after this one. He will get to that record just as he has gotten to so many other records in Cleveland baseball history. And again, as we zoom in, once you know he's already finished, what, top five in the MVP or top six, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times. It's going to happen again this year. This will be the 7th. Is he going to pass Judge or Cal Raleigh? I don't think so, barring injury. But I think he's 3rd right now, especially with Cleveland's surge. Maybe by war, he's 4th or 5th. But he's right there once again. He is amazing. I'm so lucky to watch this part of his career. I'm so glad that he's still in his prime. You know, like you could have said, like, he's, you know, I missed it. Like, no, man, he's still pretty much as good as ever. And man, oh, man, what a baseball player.
One thing I want to note with him, one of our favorite clubs in baseball history is the 300-300 club, which is 300 career homers and 300 career steals. There are only 8 players ever, 8 players ever with 300-300, which is remarkable considering how much more power there has been in the game and the types of athletes that are able to do this now way more than we used to have. And yet compiling that over a full career is very difficult to do. I think we will have more players enter this group as baseball history crawls forward because stealing bases is easier than ever. That being said, the 8 members, Barry Bonds, Willie Mays, Andre Dawson, Bobby Bonds, Reggie Sanders, Steve Finley, A-Rod, and Carlos Beltran. Jose Ramirez currently sits, after last night, at 280 career homers and 276 career steals, unless
we'll get there next year.
Gets space jammed or loses his cleats.
I hope to be there. I hope it happens at home next season. And as you mentioned, we've talked about the 300-300 club. I hope I get to watch him. And it's cool that he's like on such an even pace for both.
That I love that, right? Like you do not know what he's going to get to first. And he is probably going to become the 2nd youngest player to enter this group after Barry Bonds. So Bonds got there at 30 years old because great player. After that, Bobby Bonds is the 2nd youngest player at age 33. Ramirez turns 33, I believe, this offseason.
Wow.
And so I think, turns 33 in September. So that is just an unbelievable thing. And he is just an unbelievable player. We were looking at Hanley for this for a long time. Mm-hmm. And the second that Hanley turned 31, he I don't want to say he got fat, but.
No, I mean, you just look at him. I mean, the numbers and what he looked like speaks for itself. Like he finished his career with 271 homers, 281 stolen bases. There are 25 members, for those wondering, in the 250-250 club, including most recently Jose Altuve, who recently hit his 250th career home run. So does Altuve have another 50 homers in him? He's already has 300 stolen bases. I think probably. So Altuve is a probably, but also not a certainty. I mean, he's already 35, and again, does he have 50 more home runs in him? I don't know if it's as much of a sure thing, whereas Ramirez, as we mentioned, like that's happening next season.
Steals after turning 30. This is age 31 season and on. Hanley Ramirez, career steals after that. 20. Jose Ramirez, 74. Counting. So his desire and ability to keep running is just so admirable. Oh, yeah. What an amazing player. And I'm jealous that you get to watch him all the time.
Yeah, no, he is the coolest. I guess one other guy to mention, I just now doing Stathead. 55 members in the 200-200 club. The most notable one from that group who is active is Christian Yelich, who is at 227 homers and 220 stolen bases. Does Yelich have another 80 steals in him? He's got 15 this year. I mean, again, Josh Naylor has changed the way if you want to steal 30 bases, you probably can. Is Christian Yelich going to have that want to get to 300-300? I wouldn't rule it out. I think whether him, like 80 more steals for Christian Yelich, 50 more homers for Jose Altuve is an interesting conversation because of the age and the era. But yeah. Those are the other guys to at least watch. And then obviously like much younger Julio, like dude, Julio, he's already at 100. He's 25. So we're going to get like, there's going to be more of them. But those are way farther down the line.
You got to hit Yelich behind Bryce Turang. You get runners on first and second, double steal. Turang takes third. Yelich gets the steal as the trail runner.
We're just trail stealing to 300. Yeah. Oh my gosh. That would be, Pat Murphy would certainly appreciate that. Anyway, Jose Ramirez, you are fantastic. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we're going to talk about some future members of the 300 club, Connor Griffin, and a whole bunch more prospect chatter after the break.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. I think one of the more impressive traits about my pal Jordan is that he can predict the future. That means it is time for Jordan's Prospect Hut. No one out prospects the hut. All right, Jordan.
What a lovely intro.
Thank you.
So complimentary. This is one of my favorite segments. Obviously, I'm biased, but I feel like you enjoy it at least a little bit too. When I picture this hut, what does this hut look like? You know, we've been on vacation. You got like kind of like a poolside, beachside thing where you get your frozen strawberry daiquiris, but instead, it's me telling you that Kalen Culpepper is going to be freaking awesome. Not quite as refreshing, with 80 but hopefully screens a little up, bit more informative.
And MILB TV is just rolling on every single TV. So why are we doing this now? Most of the prospect prognosticating websites update their prospect lists around this time. Why this time, you may ask? Well, I can tell you that even though I know less about prospects than Jordan. It is because the draft has just happened. So all the new players from the draft are on these lists. And the trade deadline has just happened. And I'm not sure if you saw, but prospects got traded at the trade deadline. And so this is a great time to take a breath and take a snapshot of where prospectdom is at a current point in time. Let's start at the very top, Jordan. Who is the best prospect in baseball?
So it seems that, again, you know, you mentioned all those outlets we're talking. MLB Pipeline is the most recent one, but of course, Baseball America. I think Just Baseball does great work. You know, of course, the longtime standards in the industry. We got Keith Law and Baseball Prospectus and Fangraphs, of course. So a lot of possible outlets to choose from. I don't have a preferred one. I'm reading all of it. I'm taking it all in and making my own assessments. Well, maybe we have preferred ones, but that's not the point of what we're going to
my
share
preferred
on this,
outlet is
this
calling
episode.
Jordan.
Yeah, right. So there you go. It's this segment. But it seems like there are two answers to this question. And they are both very interesting answers. One of them is Connor Griffin, who I mentioned at the end of last segment. Connor Griffin, the top prospect for the Pittsburgh Pirates, someone who was drafted out of a Mississippi high school just a year ago. After that group of elite college performers, Connor Griffin was regarded as the best high school player, but it felt like, okay, like this is an unbelievable athlete, unbelievable physical tool set. This might take a while. You know, he's going to have to, you know, adjust to major, you know, to big league or to pro pitching. This could be a slow burn. Like the outcome might be amazing, but we're going to have to be patient with this one. Instead, Connor Griffin just went ham immediately. And he basically was already making some swing adjustments before he even signed. And then since he has joined the Pirates organization, has just been on an absolute tear. He has hit his way to high A already, where he is still, you know, one of the youngest players. He is playing mostly shortstop, but also center field. He has ridiculous raw power. He is an almost maybe an 80 grade runner, or at least close to it. Everything you could want And he is a lovely young Southern gentleman with a wonderful Mississippi accent and a very funny mustache for a, you know, 19.
Well, gee.
Connor Griffin is, this is an like, as far as just percentile outcome for a first pro season, we are as about as far to the end of the, you know, right tail spectrum end here of just like best possible outcome. And he could be in the big leagues next year, and unbelievable that the Pirates now have this other incredible guy. So that is an answer. Give me some Connor Griffin thoughts.
That is an answer quickly on Connor Griffin. I am fascinated by him because, like you mentioned, the conversation was, what an athlete. If it all breaks right, it could be franchise altering. And when the Pirates drafted him, you and I, and we'll be honest, we were kind of not out. We were low. Because our thought process was, do you trust the Pittsburgh freaking Pirates to get the most out of a position player? Their track record for player development, I don't know if you've seen the standings any of the last, I don't know, 10 years, but the Pirates are not good at this. Okay, now, yes, they're under-resourced, and yes, they have smart people working there, but the results speak for themselves. And so in my mind, it was like, when is Connor Griffin going to fix the swing? And it just happened right away. Just like,
whether that was him or the Pirates or some combination, honestly, it's kind of hilariously a similar conversation we were just having about Paul Skeens, where it's like, okay, yeah. I mean, this is a generational pitcher, but he's going to have to make some adjustments if he's going to dominate the big leagues. Like, oh, nope, yep, he just did that right away, and he's amazing. And it does appear that Connor Griffin still has a lot more to prove in the upper minors, and there's still a good amount of swing and miss, and so we don't want to crown him too fast. But, I mean, like I said, you can't really ask for much more from a first pro season, and the fact that it is not a slow burn, this is a guy who is probably going to be in the big leagues at age 20, is you just don't see that from high school draft picks very often. And you mentioned low. It was more about, right, you mentioned that developmental fit. It's not that we thought it was a bad pick by the Pirates. Absolutely. At that point, once all those other college guys are off the board, yes, take the swing on Connor Griffin. Guess what? The Pirates can't afford players like Connor Griffin in free agency. They could barely afford way worse than Connor Griffin in free agency.
He could barely afford Connor Griffin in the draft.
right. So, like, come on. So, anyway, but he is. You gotta just give him the credit, and obviously the Pirates have at least not screwed it up. You could at least say that so far they've let him become a really, really, really special player. But he is not the only answer. He's not the only answer. That is because while he is number one on Pipeline's list, I believe the player who is number one on more of the other lists is Kevin McGonigal. Now, this is an interesting contrast because Kevin McGonigal, who, unlike Connor Griffin, when Connor Griffin gets off the bus, you're like, oh, yeah, that's the best player. That guy over there. Kevin McGonigal is not that. He is a lot closer to the Jose Ramirez type, where
McGonigal. You're like, he could really help our office softball league.
Or, you know, like,
our team.
Nice little player. You know, Kevin
McGonigal. Nice little player.
And it is funny because when Kevin McGonigal was drafted, this was two years ago, he was the 2023 draft, out of a high school in Pennsylvania, 37th overall pick. He was well regarded. But with him, it was less about, you know, with Connor Griffin, it was, okay, he's got everything, but can he hit? Kevin McGonigal, it was, okay, he can hit, but like, what else is he really going to give you? Is he going to hit for power? Is he a shortstop? You know, but in this case, it's like, oh, hold on a second. No. This dude can hit. This dude can really, really, really hit. And that became very apparent basically immediately last year in his first full pro season, where he hits .309. He walks 46 times, only strikes out 28 times, only hits 5 homers last year, but you're starting to see the batted ball data improved this year. He's still walking more than he's striking out. He's playing shortstop better than people expected. And so while he's still this kind of stocky guy that maybe isn't going to hit 30 homers in a season, the confidence level in his hit tool is about as high as we've seen on a player in a really, really, really long time since sorry to bring up his name on the podcast, Wander Franco. Like, in terms of like this kind of tool set,
he will hit.
Hit tool, contact, like, it is there. And so for him to now join Max Clark, who was drafted Remarkably, that same year, I mean, holy crap, what a combo to pick those two guys at the top of the draft. Is really puts the Tigers in a pretty exciting spot. Now, are we going to see either of those guys in the big leagues this year? I don't think so. But that is why Kevin McGonigal, because you want to have the guys that you know are going to hit, and you don't really know, you can't really be so confident about that for almost any minor league player. But McGonigal has kind of, because of the numbers that he's putting up, both service level and the underlying stuff, it's about as good as it gets.
And I think it's interesting because he's the type of player that maybe 10 years ago wouldn't be number one on a prospect list because he is shorter and doesn't have obvious raw power. He's not an elite runner. He's probably a second baseman. And I think I understand, but like the data we have now about what makes a good hitter allows websites and scouts and teams to feel more confident in evaluating and projecting a player like McGonigal. Let's fly a little bit further down the rest of this list and talk about some of the biggest up arrow guys, some of the breakout players that have flown up lists this year. Who are some you want to mention?
Yeah, I definitely want to mention Kalen Culpepper, who he was just one of my favorite players in the draft last year. A shortstop out of Kansas State. We interviewed him at the combine, and he was someone where it was like, okay, you were kind of hoping because he had this huge sophomore year, and you thought, okay, is the power going to show up even more as a junior? Didn't really, only 11 homers, and again, this is in an environment where the homers are just flying out of the park, and so you want to see more homers. But the bat speed was there. The athleticism was there. He showed he could play shortstop in junior year, and he's continued to play shortstop. And by the way, just quickly on McGonigal, like, he's basically only played shortstop this year. Whether he sticks there long-term, I don't know. But I think the fact that he is regarded as clearly the number one prospect right now has to also be a reflection of the confidence in his ability to play shortstop. Because if he was certainly a second baseman, I don't know if it would be as much of a slam dunk. So I'll just mention that. But back to
Culpepper, that is my personal evaluation.
Sure.
I'm just kind of out that's on. Fine. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. That's and you might be right, but I have to assume that that's part of the confidence there in him at number one. But Culpepper, I mean, he was someone where it was like, oh, he's going to be an awesome third baseman. Can he take it short? Now it looks like he might just be an awesome shortstop. And he's got 17 homers in his first full pro season. Has hit his way to Double A. Awesome bat speed. Just such a, and he's also interesting because he's not that in the Connor Griffin mold of that physically impressive from a height and just build standpoint, but the way he moves in the box is about as fun as you're going to see. And the Twins have a lot of really exciting young hitters, and that he's someone that has now joined that Walker Jenkins and Emmanuel Rodriguez. And he's really important because as we look at this next generation of this next era of Twins baseball, we have to know how they're going to score runs. I think there's reasons to be optimistic on the mound still, whether they keep Joe Ryan or not, but this offensive group is not a group that there's too much to be excited about. I know Luke Kuechel's been awesome too when he's been on the field, but Culpepper could be a huge part of that, and I'm excited to see, because I expect him to probably hit his way to the big leagues next year too.
You have three other names on this list, all of whom, none of whom I had heard of when I woke up on April 1st this year. That is Nate George, Bo Davidson, and Tyson Lewis. Who are these gentlemen? What do they do for a living?
So we'll go fast on these ones and then we'll hit the couple teams. So Nate George is a real fun pop-up one. 16th round pick out of high school. You don't see a lot of those. This is the kind of strategy like the Brewers have employed recently where it's like, let's just draft a bunch of high schoolers. Some of them will sign, some of them won't, but we believe in their upside and we believe that they will sign. I mean, this is where scouting becomes very important, understanding who's willing to sign. The Orioles identified Nate George as kind of a late riser, Illinois high school. And this dude is kind of built like a little tank, and this is another one where it's like, holy crap, like this dude's hitting 350 in the minor leagues as a 19-year-old, and we never really saw him perform that much against showcase competition because he wasn't highly ranked. Now he's 19 and hit his way to high A with the Orioles, and again, the Orioles need pitchers more than they need hitters, but this is not, you know, of course the Orioles are picking the top five. Of course they have all these guys. It's like, no.
This is a 16.
This is a hell of a scouting find, and someone who also stolen 39 bases. So he's definitely an up arrow athlete. I would say that Tyson Lewis and Bo Davidson also fit that for different reasons. Tyson Lewis was more highly rated. He was on my top 50 prospects in last year's draft, high schooler out of Nebraska. That's another one more along the lines of Connor Griffin, where it's like, wow, what an athlete. Is he going to be able to hit whatsoever? So far, he's with the Cincinnati Reds. He is striking out a ton, and the plate discipline is very bad. He's also hit a ball 118 miles an hour already in Arizona, which, again, short list of humans that have done that. So let's just put that into context. So he is one that is probably going to take a longer time, but his physical tool set is amazing. And then Bo Davidson, finally. I mean, this is also another amazing scouting find. An undrafted player out of a junior college, I believe in North Carolina, for the San Francisco Giants. And he's just tearing it up. He's hit his way to double A. Another guy that you're kind of betting on the athlete. And some of the great stories about him being scouted. I know there have been a couple really good stories written by Giants writers about the people that saw Bo Davidson in junior college. But yeah, that's one where like there are a lot of junior college athletes that teams are just terrified to even bother with because this is another one of them. He wasn't drafted. You know, it's like people didn't know who he was. He wasn't even drafted. But he signs as a free agent, and now he looks like one of the more promising hitters in the Giants system. So he's a fun one, and definitely another example of why scouts are still pretty damn important.
I want to move over to teams, and I want to talk about the Mets. Because I think the Mets are uniquely positioned right now as a contender with prospects in the high levels that they held on to. Prospects that may legitimately contribute this season. And that begins on the mound, where the Mets over the last couple of months have struggled mightily. The Frankie Montas experiment has gone about as well as a bad experiment. Nailed it. He is being moved to the bullpen indefinitely. And according to Mets writer Anthony DiComo, end of the program, that spot in the rotation is either going to be filled by Brandon Sproat or Nolan McLean, a pair of Mets prospects that are highly rated, highly ranked. Jordan, can you run us through these two gentlemen and the impact you think they might have on the 2025 Mets?
Yeah, very different tracks, right? You have Sproat, who was drafted by the Mets twice, actually, at the University of Florida. He's just throws really hard, but it's like, okay, is he ever going to throw enough strikes to be a starting pitcher? Is he ever going to miss enough bats? Because even though he's always thrown hard, it hasn't always contributed to consistent run prevention or consistent strikeouts. He's been in AAA, I believe, the whole season and would be sort of the more obvious pick of like the next man up. He was probably next in line after Blade Tidwell, who of course they've since traded away. He has that more traditional, hard-throwing starting pitcher background. Nolan McLean, I think, is a lot more fun. This is a guy who was a two-way player in college at Oklahoma State, had ridiculous raw power. They let him hit all the way to double-A until he was striking out 50% of the time. They move him to the mound full-time, and he's really taken off. He reached triple-A in the middle of this season. And it seems like McLean has pretty comfortably passed Sproat as a prospect. The question is which one of them we trust right now more, I think, is what we're kind of going to find out. It wouldn't really surprise me if either of them end up pitching big league innings down the stretch, because clearly the Mets need it. Jonah Tong is another one who might be even higher than both of those guys. He's another huge breakout this season, who was just promoted to AAA. He's much younger. I think it's less likely we see Tong this season, but it feels like they're probably going to ask for both Sproat and McLean to help them out down the stretch. And to your point,
yeah,
that's not, you know, it's good that you hang on to these guys. Do you want to be like relying this heavily on them? Maybe not. It's both exciting and terrifying, I think, is the way to fit. And that's before we even get to some of the hitters.
Yeah, I saw McLean in camp throwing on the backfields. I was super impressed. I mean, it's a very unique type of athlete on the mound. The best comp I have for people would be Michael Lorenzen, just from a physicality perspective, which also fits because two-way player, right? Just stocky, strong. You look at him, you're like, you don't wrestle? You pitch? You sure? But the slider is really, really good.
A little tall to wrestle.
He's a little taller than Lorenzen. But I really like McLean. And then the other dude, I know he's probably not going to come up this year, but the guy that I've gotten a ton of good reports on this year is Carson Bench for the Mets, the outfielder who they took in the first round last year out of Oklahoma State. Like, people are starting to think that this guy is going to be a very special hitter. He has a chance to stick in center field. He won't be plus there, but he'll be probably good enough to be there. And the bat looks real.
Yeah. Yeah. No, Benj is another one who's clearly made as about as big of a jump on these rankings as we've seen. And whether they're going to need him or want him this season, he is their top prospect, I think, pretty comfortably at this point. Because of what he's doing in the minors feels a lot more bankable than any of the pitchers because they're pitchers and you just don't know. Jet Williams is another one who has been around for a little bit longer. He's kind of more of the, I think what Jet Williams is struggling with is he's going to face some of the same questions as Acuna, Luis Angel.
Luis Angel, like, you do a lot of Ronald.
Things. Yeah. Yes. Luis Angel Acuna, where it's like, you do a lot of things. You're stealing bases. You're playing multiple positions. You look like a really fun player. You're 5'8", and like, how much of an impact can you make? I think Jet Williams' hit tool is clearly better than Luis Angel, so I think there's a better chance. I don't think we're going to see him this season, but he has also reached AAA at 21, and he's, especially since he was so injured last season, that's been good to see.
Before we take a look at players we think will make an impact this season elsewhere around the league, any other names you just want to throw out there that are in your brain that you're like excited about, that you're thinking about, sure, that you're hearing good things about?
Yeah, just a couple. I mean, the fact that the Brewers, Jesus Mate was the real breakout, but the fact they have this other infielder right alongside him and Luis Peña, who's also kind of hit his way to being a top 30, 50 prospect, is not as memorable of a name as Jesus Mate, right? Luis Peña versus Jesus Mate, but both of those guys are clearly elite prospects, and that should not be taken lightly. Pittsburgh has a bunch of guys. I mean, I hope we see Bubba Chandler down the stretch here at some point. They have some lower level hitters like Edward Florentino, who's really impressed. Tony Blanco Jr., who is hitting balls 120 in the Florida State League right now, already has some of the biggest raw power in the minor leagues. And so, yeah, so they've got some fun ones. Then the Dodgers just have like infinite outfielders. And I know they didn't end up making any big trades. They actually acquired, you know, and more outfield prospects in James Tibbs and Zach Earhart in that Dustin May trade. But they already have so many outfielders, Yair Hope and Josue DePaula and Quintero and Mike Sirota. So how those guys shuffle out, because the Dodgers outfield remains a question kind of long term. So how quickly we see any of those guys in LA, don't expect them this season. But that is also something I'm thinking about.
And then in terms of the rest of this year, I think David Price like ruined our brains back in 2008, right? It was hotshot pitcher on prospect lists, a starter brought up to dominate out of the bullpen. And then since then, we've just been searching for the next version of that. Now, we've had different types of guys that have come up late in the season to make an impact. Orion Kirkering a few years ago, going from like low A to pitching in the playoffs in 15 minutes. Who are the guys that you like look on these prospect lists and you're like, you could play in the playoffs this year?
Right. Yeah, that's a good question. So we're going to have a lot of call-ups in the next week or so, because teams can now call guys up and keep their rookie eligibility because they're not going to get enough service time days. So we're going to have a lot of prospects called up. How many of them are going to be to good teams that are, we just mentioned the Mets is a clear example. We know that's going to happen, but a lot of these other ones, I'm excited to see J.J. Weatherholt play in St. Louis in September, but that's not, you know, not expecting the Cardinals to be in the postseason. Dylan Beavers, same thing with Baltimore. Samuel Basayo, right? I'm excited to see those guys get at bats. As terms of on the mound, I mean, Peyton Tolley's one that is really interesting. Peyton Tolley, big left-hander for the Boston Red Sox. He has also flown through the system this year. He's this enormous guy, also a former two-way player. He has a special fastball. He's not throwing 100, but he's throwing pretty hard. He's got incredible characteristics. He's got incredible extension. He's this huge left-hander. They put him in AAA. I could see him coming up and being a bullpen weapon for Boston down the stretch, or maybe in October, just because he has that elite trait that they could put in their bullpen. Now, they already have a ton of lefty relievers, so I'm not sure that is something that they are prioritizing. That said, he's still someone I'm watching.
Nice. That's it. Thanks for taking me. I guess I should mention Andrew Painter, just because it's been a very odd year.
He's someone people
are
probably wondering about. Yep.
Like, so, right, the track, the trajectory here, Andrew Painter, TJ comes back. They kind of slow play him, the Phillies do, last year into this year. Highly ranked pitching prospect. And he's been fine. He's just kind of been fine. And the Phillies have like 7,000 other pitchers. this year in the minor leagues in AAA. He has made 16 starts. His ERA is 5.42. Is that a guy you want to push into the big leagues to pitch in the playoffs? Maybe, probably not. Does he just take Ranger Suarez's rotation spot next spring when Suarez leaves in free agency? I think is maybe the most likely outcome.
Yeah, that seems more realistic. This doesn't seem like someone, his trajectory and the season that he's having and what he was before the surgery, which is, again, like one of the best pitching prospects we've seen in a long time. That's why there was so much hype. You'd rather maintain that possibility than be like, hey, dude, go throw max effort in the bullpen in October for your big league debut. That just doesn't really make a lot of sense for me. So maybe if there's an injury that he would be one of their best starters available, I'm skeptical we are going to see him this season. But I agree with you, next year he will definitely be a main character for the Phillies if Dombrowski doesn't trade him, which it sounds like he didn't want.
He won't.
So he doesn't want to. Maybe that changes this offseason, but who knows. All right. Thank you for joining me in my prospect.
Thanks.
Hope you had a good time. Thanks, we're going to take a break. When we return, we're going to go around the league. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. A few more topics before we get out of here. Let's go around the league. All right, Jake Mintz, I have to confess, I look a little bit foolish after tweeting on July 29th. I was looking at the standings and I said, "Ooh boy, NL East, NL Central. This is looking pretty spicy. We got, you know, the Phillies are only a game and a half back of the Mets. This wasn't that long ago, folks. We got the Cubs." I know the Brewers are playing well. It's July 28th. Cubs are only a game back. Deadline's coming up. Cubs are going to make some big moves, right? Sure, man. These are the division races that we're watching. Okay, you know, Mariners are three back. Padres are four back. Okay, you know, they're in it. They're in it. But clearly, these are the two to watch. I mean, so I put out a Twitter poll and I said, hey, what's it going to be? Which division race is more compelling? 64% of you fine listeners, followers, said the NL Central. Oh, man, Cubs, Brewers, NL East. Who cares about that? Turns out both of those answers were incorrect. As the Phillies and Brewers have surged ahead, the Mets and Cubs can't get out of their own way. And instead, we sit here on August 13th, my two-year wedding anniversary. Shouts out to my awesome wife, Bailey Bowers. And the two West divisions are tied at the top, and the central divisions are not that. So, Jake, let's talk first about the National League West, the Dodgers and Padres, one of our favorite rivalries in baseball. Here we are.
Dad's last.
The Dodgers cannot seem to beat the Angels, and the Padres can keep beating the Giants because the Giants aren't very good. And the Dodgers and Padres are tied here with a bunch of games against each other coming up. And three this weekend, and then I think four a week later. Buckle up, folks! This is gonna be a good time. So, what are your big picture thoughts on these Dodgers and Padres?
I have small picture thoughts. Last night's Angels Dodgers game was just a joy to watch, with Kenley Jansen serving it up to Ohtani, former Angel versus former Dodger, and in my mind, I'm like, when you have those two facing off, there's this underlying implication that is obviously not true, that they were traded for one another, right? It's like, oh, former Dodger, former Angel, here they go.
Yeah,
not really. Funny, yeah. Sure, yeah. And Ohtani takes him deep, and you're like, oh, Dodgers win again. No, because the Angels claw back in the bottom half against a LA bullpen that remains just not very good. Alex Vesia with some bad walks, single up the middle. Ben Kasperias comes in, allows a run, locks it down, goes to the bottom of the 10th. There's a weird bunt. Angels win. And it's like the Dodgers seem to be receiving their karmic comeuppance for treating the regular season like spring training, right? They have been so passive and so focused on the long game all year in a way that lessens the overall importance of the regular season. Now, I know we have 162 games and it's already into each individual game is not important. It's not like the Dodgers or the villains creating that. But the way that they've approached it, it's like, I am not watching that much of the Dodgers this regular season because they, by their actions as an organization, are telling me that it matters less, right? They're telling me, oh, well, we're just going to, you know, suck every last bullet out of Luis Garcia's arm for 2.5 months and send him a packing. It's like, what am I supposed to watch that? And now that they're tied with the Padres, who are operating, frankly, in the exact opposite manner, right? Like, let's go do this now. Everyone pitch as much as you can. Please, we need you. Please, we need you. I'm fascinated by this division race, and it is such a great juxtaposition of how these two teams operate. And not to, you know, frame the Padres as David and the Dodgers as Goliath, but it's kind of like Goliath and tiny little baby Goliath.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think the history between these two teams over the last half decade is very fun. We know it's mixed results in the postseason, but listen, we've had a lot of moments, even this season, where it was like, here we go, Dodgers. There was a moment earlier this year where it's like, Dodgers, you sweating? And then they just took care of business and they built that lead back up. Maybe that is about to happen. I mean, the thing is, like, the Dodgers are now pretty healthy, not in the bullpen, where clearly they're dealing with a lot of issues, but their hitters are back. Their starting pitchers are mostly back now. Like, they kind of have their guys. Snell's pitching. He's pitching well. Glasnow looks pretty good. Like, Yamamoto got crushed the other day. You know, like, you can't be leaning on the injuries anymore. This is your team. Now is the time to go win the division again. And so we will see if the Dodgers respond accordingly. And we're going to find out, because these teams are going to play 7 times in the next, you know, 10 to 12 days. And I will be locked in. I'm very excited for these games, and credit for San Diego for. And by the way, this triple play was ridiculously cool. I mean, this.
So
is
I wanted to bring it up quickly.
One of the cooler aesthetic triple plays we've had that I can remember
ever. And it's a shame and a gift that Ohtani hit into this, because the yeah. way that it is framed to the public is Shohei Ohtani hits it a triple play. It's like, you know, the Dodgers win 5-0, Ohtani goes 0-4. Shohei Ohtani's Dodgers win as Freddie Freeman blasts mm-hmm. 3 home runs, right? Because we're victims. I mean, we're culprits here. The algorithm, it's Ohtani-fied, obviously. However, I am happy that Ohtani hit this, because more people will now get to see Zach Neto's dope-ass play than otherwise yeah. would have if... I'm sorry. The Dodgers were playing a guy last night that I had never heard of before in center field.
Oh, yes. And it was Justin Dean. If Justin Dean hits into this triple play, it's not being shared.
We're not
as
talking
much.
About it.
It's not. It's not. Yeah, but it's also funny, the framing of, like, Ohtani, this idiot. What was he thinking hitting into that triple play?
Right. Like,
what a buffoon.
He roped it.
It's like, no, he hit it pretty hard. Zach Neto is just freaking awesome. Zach Neto's awesome. The Angels still awesome. Are maddening. Again, 5-0 against the Dodgers this year. Hopefully they at least finish above 500 this season. I think they maybe probably will. I don't know. Zach Neto is the guy on that team where I'm just like, this dude is a baller. Like, this guy.
Baller.
I know they've had some other nice seasons, and Chanuel and Taylor baller. Ward. Adele's having
a... No.
Neto is a beast, man. That guy is just a freaking stud. But anyway, so triple play, huge win for the Angels. And we'll see if they, man, again, we'll see. Tonight we got Ohtani on the mound, amazing, right, against Kyle Hendricks. This is going to be the ultimate vibe, you know, test, vibe check of who's got it going on here. Angels with the possibility to go 6-0 against the Dodgers this season against Ohtani would be something else. If that does happen or doesn't happen, we'll probably talk about it on Friday. Padres, you're doing good. Keep it up. Let's go to the American League West, Jake Mintz, where the Seattle Mariners are not the Milwaukee Brewers, but they are also extremely hot, as they have now won 8 in a row, I believe. Yes, W8 for the Mariners. They have caught up to the Astros. Last year, the Mariners famously blew a 10-game lead to division lead. This year, it is the Astros' turn, as they have blown a 7-game lead over the last month or so, and they are now tied with the Mariners atop the American League West, as Houston got their butt whooped by Boston last night. More on that in a second. But Seattle is cooking. We already talked about it on Monday, obviously, with their sweep of the Rays. They go into Baltimore, get a gritty 1-0 win. George Kirby looks terrific. That is good to see. It was kind of like a back to, you know, Mariners of more recent years, where it's like, all right, George Kirby, your pitcher's going to dominate, and maybe they'll squeak out one run. This has not been the recipe for the Mariners recently, because they've been hitting so well. But this was a nice little blast from the past here. But yeah, Mariners look great. Astros look good in the first game of the series against Boston. But this is, I mean, here we go. We'll be locked into this race too. In the similar sense, it's a very different franchise back and forth history, but in the same way as the Padres trying to finally take down the Dodgers, the Mariners have had good teams recently. They've never, of course, been able to take down Houston atop this division. Well, they've come very close. Of course, the history goes back even farther than that, have not won the division since 2001. So, but it's right there. It's right there. It's right in front of them. They will have to earn it, but they are playing more than well enough to make it happen. As for when these two teams play again, I believe we still have to wait a little bit longer. They play, yes. So they only have 3 games remaining between the Astros and Mariners. That is the third to last series of the season in Houston. So otherwise, they're going to have to kind of do their own thing, and we will be locked in on that series when we get there.
Jordan Schusterman, I come to you with breaking news.
Yes.
We have a tweet from the Minnesota Twins.
Oh my gosh! Okay, I didn't see this. I don't. Is this is
a letter?
Did they sell the team?
A letter from the Pollard family. Jordan, don't read it yet. I'm gonna read it to you right now.
All right, they're showing it on our pod screen, but I'm not looking. Go ahead, read it to me.
For more than 4 decades, our family has had the privilege of owning the Minnesota Twins. This franchise has become part of our family story. Congrats, I guess. As it has for our employees, our players, this community, and Twins fans everywhere. So what have we learned from that paragraph? Nothing. Over the past several months, we explored a wide range of potential investment and ownership opportunities. Our focus throughout has been on what's best for the long-term future of the Twins. We've been fully open to all possibilities. Anything you've learned yet, Jordan?
All of this was assumed already being figured out. Okay,
you knew this.
I've learned nothing.
People like the Twins, and the Twins might get sold. After a detailed and robust process, our family will remain the principal owner of the Minnesota Twins. To strengthen the club in a rapidly evolving sports landscape, one that demands strong partnerships, fresh ideas. Why are you referencing fresh ideas if you are not selling the team? Whatever. We are in the process of adding 2 significant limited partnership groups, each of whom will bring a wealth of experience and share our family values. Fans, back to my voice, fans don't want wealth of experience. They want wealth.
Bingo. Period. I was about to say the
last
exact
paragraph.
Same thing.
We see and hear the passion from our partners, the community, and Twins fans. That passion inspires us to trade away Carlos Correa and 9 other players from our big league roster. This ownership group is committed to building a winning team sometimes, and culture for sure, for this region, one that Twins fans are proud to cheer for. Now, there are a lot of different things here. Okay, we thought the Twins were going to get sold. We thought that the impending sale was influencing their deadline activity, where they trade everyone away to cut a bunch of payroll. And now the Pollard family owns a team is saying, I'm not going anywhere. My favorite part of this, and I think that maybe I'm reading too much into this, to release this statement in the middle of you getting spanked by the Yankees again. Twins fans just watched the Yankees kick your frickin' ass for the 99th time in this century. And for you to hop in and say, we're staying and everything's good in Twinsland. Like, what are we doing here, brother?
You mentioned the timing. I think that's less relevant. It is funny, the optics, I agree. But as was made very clear in this entire statement, this is something that has been in the works, or I guess not in the works.
Out of the works.
for a year plus. Hey, man, you know, you watch Eduardo Tait swing the bat, and you don't want to be so quick brother. To sell that team.
Brother. Dude, so the other thing is we are in the process of adding two significant limited partnership groups. So that means they're selling parts of the team to bring people in. But there's no way that this was plan A. And it is hard to sell this for sure. As plan A, right?
Also, remember, Manfred, when asked about this at All-Star Game, this was when he was like, I know things you don't know, right? This is when he was like, I think he said there will be a transaction that takes place.
That transaction Carlos Correa to the Astros?
Which could be what they're referring to in the statement of like selling off some smaller parts, which maybe those are like people that at one day will become majority owners. Who knows? It doesn't matter because to your point, this is not the press release that fans... No. We're looking forward to. And while I will say that, like, I mean, we're going to probably have to digest more of this and talk more about it on Friday, but there are some things still to cling to with Minnesota and things to like with, as I mentioned earlier, we're talking about Kalen Culpepper. Like, this isn't necessarily like they're about to lose 120 games, but still... It was in need of actual fresh ideas, actual fresh direction, actual fresh wealth, and instead
of experience.
Oh, sorry. Okay, cool.
Wealth. We have so much wealth
of experience.
Let's move on because this pod is going too long.
We don't want experience. Experience can't get us free agents.
No. Showing up to a free agent meeting and being like, "We have experience."
Whoa, really?
Kyle Tucker's awesome. Like, sick, bro.
One all year? Right. $10.5 million? Okay.
Meanwhile, up north, the Milwaukee Brewers, just across the border, are currently on a W11. We've talked about them quite a bit. We won't do that here, except for if they win tonight and secure W12, although maybe it's a day game. Yes, 2:10 Eastern. If they win tonight, they will secure free Hamburglars for the everyone who goes to a George Webb location. George Webb is a burger and diner, kind of seems like a regional Denny's type deal. If there's a whole backstory we've talked about on the show before. If they win 12 in a row, everyone gets a free burger. Go Brewers, go. I cannot get enough of this incredible logo for George Webb, the guy holding the bat. It is the G is his mouth and the W is his torso. Just go look it up. It's very delightful. I hope the Brewers are able to pull this off.
Yeah. And remember, they had an 11-game winning streak earlier this season that ended in a 1-0 loss to the Mariners. So Pirates, a little bit of a weaker opponent. We will see how it goes. Woodruff, yes, against Mitch Keller this afternoon.
Woodruff to secure their burgers. Oh, that's perfect. Oh,
it just feels right.
So probably love it.
He's probably been dreaming about this since he was drafted.
Last thing before we get out of here, I'm going to debut a new segment here called That Can't Happen. Okay, That Can't Happen. It's simple. Sometimes it's a missed cutoff throw. Sometimes... Like when the Pirates drafted someone in the Rule 5 draft who wasn't eligible to be drafted. Remember that? Like, that can't happen. And the most reason that can't happen is what is going on with Shohei Ohtani and his agent, Nez Bilelo, who are being sued for their role in, this is via the AP report, quote, sabotaging $240 million real estate deal. Because this is Ohtani, this makes news. Because it is a $240 million real estate deal, this makes news. This cannot happen. I don't really care about the details. Do I think that Shohei Ohtani was defrauding investors or trying to get people fired or whatever? No, yeah. No, personally, I do not. He is busy trying to play baseball. He actually plays two positions, so that takes up more time and energy. Nez Bilela, Shohei Ohtani's agent. Enough, my guy. Dayenu. What are we doing here? Like, just don't get embroiled in a $240 million real estate scheme involving the most famous player in the world, who is, by the way, your only client. You have one job. Your one job, you already got this guy paid, okay? He has enough money, maybe less than he's making for the Dodgers. I'm willing to give you that. But, like, if he's going to buy a $17 million house in this housing development in Hawaii, like, don't use his likeness to bully people, allegedly. Don't even get close to it. Don't even get in the hemisphere of it. Just let Shohei Ohtani, like, do ads for Hugo Boss and New Balance, collect the checks, and just what are we doing? So, frankly, this cannot happen, Nez Bilela. I don't care how you got here. I don't care where you're going. Just don't let this happen again, because this cannot happen.
That's the thing. The headline is the headline. The details don't really matter. It's just like, these are just not headlines that should be relevant during Shohei Ohtani season. And again, if you really want to believe that this is something that Ohtani was directly involved in or at any point giving any thought to, I mean, clearly his only mistake was at some point agreeing to something vaguely related to this, maybe. Ohtani in Hawaii is kind of an interesting thing to me. But specific real estate, you know, scandals, I don't really care for. But it does feel like a place that he would just, like, chill.
Like to be.
Just hang out. Like, that's a great place, Jordan, for him to. I can understand why he might want real estate in Hawaii. That part makes sense. I don't know if that's exactly what's going on here. Whoever's at fault, whatever, it's to your broader point. However we got here, this is not a good thing.
Last thing before we leave, trivia question. How many other Major League Baseball players have ever been embroiled in a $240 million Hawaii real estate sabotage, allegedly?
I don't know. I can't stat head that. So you have to let me know.
Zero. All right. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Baseball Barbacast. Thank you to you, Jordan, for joining me. Thank you to our producers, TJ Brasier and Andrew Hartz. You can email us, baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. We will be back on Friday with another episode. Until then, thank your parents.